Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Chris. TGIDA.
How are you today?
I'm good. I'm good today. Thank goodness it's Divorce Friday.
So today we're talking about, so we've talked before in the previous couple of episodes, we've talked about the Alimony Reform Act and how it's changed divorce in Massachusetts. Today we're going to talk about major developments that have affected the Alimony Reform Act. And so as a reminder, the Alimony Reform Act was passed in 2011 and implemented in 2012, 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think it's only recently that I stopped hearing people referring to it as a new alimony law.
Yeah, that's true. I think we're done with that now. It is what it is.
It is no longer new.
Yeah, it's no longer new. Exactly.
And so since 2012, we've had a few developments. Well, we've had plenty of developments, but we've had a few developments that have fundamentally changed how we deal with that. And this is what we're talking about today, right?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. So the first one is a TCJA, which is a Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And the second one are the child support guidelines of 2021. Mm. And so we'll talk more about each one of them separately. Shall we talk about the TCJA?
Sure, yeah. And you know, that one I think has created some issues with the alimony calculation. And I'm always having to explain that to clients. And I think the obvious reason why is because we'll just jump right into the percentage part of it all, I think.
Why don't we talk about what it does in general first so that, you know, we catch up our
audience. Sure. So the TCJA, Tax Cut and Jobs Act, permanently got rid of the tax deductibility of alimony for the payor, which means that the payor can't take a dollar for dollar deduction in the amount of alimony he or she pays. So if someone was paying $60,000 in alimony, that $60,000 could come off right from the income and would reduce that person's taxable income. That's huge.
It sort of was a sweetener, if you will, for the bitterness of having to pay alimony.
Yeah, especially when there was a large amount of alimony, that person, the payor's taxes went down significantly. And so everyone wants to pay less taxes. So, okay, people would say, okay, yeah, sure, I'll do alimony because look at what I'm going to save in taxes. On the flip side, the recipient of alimony was taxed on the alimony, on their receipt of it. So on the one hand, it's getting deducted by the payor, but it's taxable to the recipient. Okay, now TCJA eliminated that. So now in essence, the alimony is pretty much just like child support because child support was never tax deductible to the payor or taxable to the recipient. So now there's really not much distinction between alimony and child support because they have the same tax effect, which is nothing. Yeah.
At least not on a tax standpoint. And so one of the things that happened before, right, is that when it was deductible to the payor and taxable for the recipient, is the reason that there is alimony is because a recipient makes less money. Mm-hmm. And needed support to pay for their lifestyle and all. And what it means is that the payor actually makes more money. I know it sort of sounds obvious, but I think it's worth pointing it out. And so therefore the payor was normally in a higher tax bracket than the recipient.
Right.
And so one of the things that was interesting about alimony beforehand was before 2017 was that if the payor pays alimony, they also pay taxes at a higher rate. So they save a bunch of money. And so let's pick a silly example, right? So they might pay 30% in taxes. And so therefore, $1,000 that they pay in alimony really is $700 on cash flow. Right? So that was sort of important. On the other side, the recipient would be in the lower tax bracket. And let's say that the tax bracket was 20%, which means that when he or she received $1,000 in alimony, they would pay $200 in taxes. And so therefore, he or she would receive $800 after taxes. So the cost for the payor was going to be $700. And the benefit for the recipient was going to be $800. And somehow or another, people like you and I, you know, were justifying why it is that we spend so much time discussing these things with clients.
Right.
Yep. Right? And so that's all gone.
Yeah, all gone. And right? those were big psychological issues for people, emotional issues, you know, when they to get that tax deduction and you know, these were things that people got kind of stuck on sometimes.
People love their tax deductions.
Right, right. And it's always, you know, people are still coming up with things that a lot of our tax code got rid of, especially the TCJA, and they still think it's the way it used to be. I'm like, no, it's not really what it does anymore.
Right.
But so last week, Chris, we were talking about need, right? Last week, our episode was what makes an alimony case? You know, how do we determine whether a case is an alimony case or not? And so one of the things we talked about was the definition in the statute as to alimony is based on need of the recipient or 30 to 35%. So these are those percentages that we were talking about. And the TCJA has affected those percentages for precisely the reason we're talking about, is because when it was tax deductible and taxable, those percentages of 30 to 35% of the difference of the party's gross income actually worked.
Right.
But now they don't work.
Right. I mean, to refresh here and to cash people up there, is that what we've discussed in the past couple of weeks is that the alimony law was originally prescribing that alimony should be something between 30 and 35% of the difference in income.
Right.
Right. But that was presuming that the income would be deductible to the payor. Right. And so now that it isn't, it's really hard.
Yeah.
Right. They wouldn't be able to pay that amount of money.
No. No, when you actually run the numbers now and you're doing it in a
I'm sorry, you've just gone silent. I don't know why.
Oh, I hear. Do you?
Are you still silent?
I'm still silent. Okay.
I cannot hear you.
I don't know.
I don't know what's happening, but somehow, I have to figure out something. Can you hear me? Okay. So.
Can you hear me?
Ah, very good. Very good. Anyway, you were trying to say something.
Yes, it's just saying that my internet connection is unstable. I do not know where I was.
We were talking about that difference in income and how TCJA got rid of it. Right. And so effectively, what it means is that if people were going to continue to use the percentages in the alimony law, 30 to 35%, right, that the payor of alimony would be stuck now with paying all of the taxes, right, on the income, meaning no deduction, and then they would have to pay 30 to 35%. And so they would end up with not very much left.
Right. And so what that would mean is that payor really doesn't have an ability to pay according to our current statute in Massachusetts as to how to calculate alimony. Mm-hmm. And one of the issues that is still out there is that they haven't changed the 30 to 35% percentages yet. And I don't know, when is that going to happen? Are they going to change them?
I don't know. I think it seems that it doesn't seem terribly urgent for them, right? But I think effectively in practice, we have changed it because as you mentioned, right, people always focus on the percentages, but the law talks about the ability to pay of the payor and the need of the recipient. And so for the recipient, if they were to get now 30 to 35%, not taxable, it's a lot more than what they would be getting before. And so it would be, it actually may not be in excess of their need, but it's in excess of what they would have been paid before. Okay. And for the payor, it would be, they would be paying more than they would have been paying before, effectively, after right. taxes. Right? Yep. So what have the legal minds of the state done about that?
Well, the financial minds have come up with, and rightly so, a new kind of range of percentages based on an after-tax analysis or a tax equivalent analysis. And so just very simply, what does that mean? Well, we look at what alimony would have been when it was taxable and deductible. Let's just say at 32.5%, because that's just middle of the road. We would run it to see what the alimony would be. And we say, okay, this is when it was tax deductible and when it was taxable. Now we're going to run it so that we find the tax equivalent number that equals that taxable number now that it's no longer taxable or tax deductible. And so it's going to be a lower number, but it's going to be the tax equivalent number, because what I'm looking at is just the income net of tax. So I'm not putting in any other type of deductible expenses like mortgage interest or, you know, any of these other items. Just looking at the tax consequence.
Right. So to use the numbers that I was using earlier, which obviously are fake numbers, right, is on $1,000 with a 20% tax rate for the recipient and a 30% tax rate for the payor, what it means is that the intent of what we're trying to do is to reduce the alimony to something like 800 for the payor and something like 700 for the recipient, which of course we cannot do, right? But it is essentially to reduce the amount of the payment down so that we negate that tax problem.
Right. So, but what that creates though, Chris, is not just one ratio or percentage, it creates a range. There's one tax equivalent number for the recipient, and there's another tax equivalent alimony figure for the payor.
So how do we pick which one?
Well, when you're in mediation, which I do a lot, we show them, here's the range, we can average it. Does this meet the need? Does this still have the payor at an ability to pay? So in anything other than litigation, and hopefully in litigation too, but not so much, we try to run the different scenarios and say, okay, which one of these seems fair and equitable to both parties? Which right. one of these percentages is going to meet the need, but also allow the payor to have money left over for his lifestyle, giving him, her, the ability to pay?
Right. So I think effectively, again, using the numbers that we have that I've used here before, right, is that the focus ends up being on how to get the recipient of alimony what they would have gotten after tax before. Right. In other words, it actually reduces the alimony burden on the payor.
Right.
Right.
Yes. And it creates lower alimony amounts.
It creates a problem because the law was talking about 30 to 35%, which is a range I think that you were referring to earlier. But now I think effectively that has translated to 23 to 28%.
Give or take, I've had it as low as 16 and as high as 30.
Of course, yeah. And that's where I think is sort of difficult because before the law was saying, okay, it's 30 to 35%, do your magical tax stuff and everything will be good, right? But now we're using a benchmark, which is the same across everyone, but does not necessarily reflect the actual impact on people. Right, depending on their income structure, they may have different kinds of tax deductions and everything, and then they end up with different kind of taxes. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think the point that you're trying to say here is that even though there is a benchmark out there, that it pays to do some analysis to see if your case fits in there.
Right. Yeah. Like I know right now that I'm not going to say they're pulling numbers out of the hat, but they're kind of pulling numbers out of the hat and saying, okay, 25% for alimony. Well, again, depending on the tax bracket of the parties and the amount of income they have, it could be less than 25%. It could be more than 25%. And I just think it's prudent to actually have an analysis to help us see exactly what that number might be.
Okay. So Justin is joining us just now.
Great.
And so I will let him in. And so so it's sometimes things like that happen, but that's how it goes. Yep. Hi, Justin. How are you doing, Justin?
Hey, good morning, Justin. How are you?
Well, for the audience, because we hope we at least think that we have an audience, right? Is that so this is Justin Kelsey, who is an attorney in Southborough, right? Is that where you are?
That's correct.
And so he's a principal of the Skylark Law Firm, and he mediates, he does collaborative law, he runs the Massachusetts Council on Family Mediation, and he's also on the board of the Massachusetts Collaborative Law Council. Basically, he does it all.
He does it all. And I will tell you, Justin, that almost every divorce professional I run into, they know who you are. So we're actually very honored to have you here with us on Divorce Friday today, because we do consider you an expert in almost everything.
Thank you for having me. I apologize for some lack of communication this week. It's been kind of a hectic week, and I actually had an unexpected Zoom court hearing this morning, I do very, very little court, to have an agreement approved, which was great. But I'm glad I could still make it on.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, the things like that pop up. So we're great, and we're glad that you're here. Chris and I have been having a conversation just about the effect of alimony, the TCJA, Tax Cut and Jobs Act effect on alimony. Especially right now, we were just having a conversation about the percentages. So that's kind of where we were.
Yeah. So we were talking about how a new benchmark has appeared, right? Which before in the Alimony Reform Act, it's, and still now actually, it says that it prescribes alimony to be between 30 and 35% of the difference in income, right? And, we've talked about need and ability to pay separately in a previous episode, so we can sort of skip over that just for now. And so we've noted that the current benchmark is more like 23 to 28%, and that it is a essentially an estimate of what it should be for people with normal taxes. Right. And we're also pointing that effectively, depending on a person's on the structure of a person's income, right, that it could really be a much wider range. Right? Do you see that at all in your practice?
I do, and I would agree with that sort of rough range for probably what we consider the majority of cases that are alimony cases. But in a sort of middle income or high middle income level, I have a few cases right now where I consider what I would consider high income, $700,000, $1 million and per year incomes. And there's two challenges there. One is doing the sort of same tax affecting calculations that I'm sure you guys can describe better than I can. We're landing more in the 20 to 23% seems like a more comparable range to the statute's 30 to 35%, because just of the higher amount of taxes being paid on the higher income level. That's one issue of sort of applying a rough, it doesn't some of the cases I'm having, we have to really look at the taxes to understand why it might not fit that rough estimation. The other practical issue is in those higher net compensation or higher gross compensation cases, they usually tend to be more complicated compensation packages too. So there's a lot of variable income, or a lot of the income is coming from vesting of stock options or restricted stock units. And so we're both addressing, you know, a percentage or and a method of payment. So, you know, is there a base and a variable portion? And, you know, is there a floor and a ceiling kind of thing? So it gets a lot more complicated with variable incomes, I find.
Right. Yeah, it sure does.
Go ahead, Diane.
I was just going to say what you're talking about, Justin, what I call like tier one alimony based on, you know, just like the base incomes. And there's tier two. I've even seen tier three. I don't know if there's ever been a tier four, but I've definitely had tier one, tier two, and tier three. So I was just wanted to, you know, when I do tell my clients, you know, of course, if there is variable income, we're not going to obligate a payor to have a payment on that variable income when that variable income may not be the same from year to year. So that's why we do structure it kind of differently. And then, like you were saying, the high and the low, you know, the of those incomes, you know, the whole, what'd you say? Not benchmarks, but you said, you know, is there a cap, right? A cap on certain income. Chris, what were you going to say?
Comes up a lot with variable income. A feeling that, okay, it's variable, but during the marriage, it's been within a particular range. And if it goes much, much higher, so the issue of the young case raises, mm-hmm. you know, whether a straight percentage is appropriate if the, you know, future income, you know, outpaces what the marital lifestyle was. And so there's, I find often challenges on both ends of that. You talk about a cap potentially that it's not sort of a, as the young case kind of talked about, I don't know if this word was used, sort of a windfall for this post-divorce increases in income. But there's also the other end of it where the variable income is often something that has been dependent on or assumed for the marital lifestyle, that there would be at least some of that. And sometimes the base pay calculation, the tier one, as you called it, is not enough to maintain, you know, what might have been that lifestyle. So for example, for the recipient spouse to qualify for a mortgage to actually own the property that they may have lived in prior. So I've seen, you know, discussions around not necessarily a floor and a cap, but prepaying of the tier two. So, you know, mm-hmm. a tier one that includes both base pay and some assumed variable, because unless there's a set monthly payment, a lot of mortgage companies, underwriters won't consider that, you know, variable alimony, the tier two or tier three, towards qualifying for a mortgage. Yep. And the ability to qualify for the mortgage really might be the ability to maintain the same lifestyle or not, to be able to live in the same house or a similar house.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. It definitely
gets complicated.
Yeah, that is actually an excellent point to consider, because you're right. You know, we're kind of getting off topic here, but the way to qualify for a mortgage is you have to have a consistent number for, you know, some it's 6 to 12 months, sometimes a history of having a consistent amount. So like you said, if there's a variable check coming in twice a year, that's not going to work for qualifying.
It makes sense. I think it makes sense also for people who are not divorced, right? Is that they don't necessarily count on their bonus money or on their executive comp to live. Some do, you know, they max out the credit cards, and that's a different issue. A benchmark when I used to be working for large companies and getting stock options and whatnot is that people would think in terms of your salary as what you live on, your bonus as what you play with, mm-hmm. and your exec comp on what you build wealth on, right? So, and so you would never, for instance, use a bonus money to try to qualify for a mortgage, because the mortgage lenders wouldn't take it anyway.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, they might take a history. They might average a history of it, maybe. But yeah, that's it is that is an interesting topic. But let's see. So getting back to the TCJA, the percentages. So we've covered that. Chris, what else did
I think one of the things that I think we mentioned earlier, and maybe Justin, it would be good to get your perspective on that, is that effectively the TCJA, meaning the repeal of the deductibility of alimony, effectively lowers the amount of alimony that gets paid, right? And so to the extent that we all focus on the numbers as opposed to the need and ability to pay, it's actually a hardship on the recipient, right? Is it something that you see happening in your practice?
I think it depends on the way that people negotiated it. I think it is clearly the TCJA took away, another way of looking at it is it took away an advantage that divorcing couples had to take a net income and increase it when taking some of that income and putting it into a lower tax bracket and having separate taxes. And presumably that was to provide some advantage back for the fact that now they have two households, right? That they're paying for more. So taking that advantage away, you're basically treating them as still having, you know, the net income of a married couple, but they're divorced and they have two households. So it is a reduction in that way for the total net income. And whether it's a hardship on just the recipient or the payor or a mix, I think is a negotiable thing. Mm-hmm. Where a lot of times what we're looking at and comparing the right, you know, the comparable percentage for what would be a current amount versus the pre-TCJA when you had the alimony deduction, you can look at the tax deduction, the tax loss just being a hardship on the recipient. You can look at it as just being a hardship on the payor, or you can look at some mixing of that, whether splitting it or splitting it proportionally. I find the way that clients, at least in a collaborative setting, are usually most comfortable looking at that is splitting it in some proportion so that the net percentage of income is coming out similar to what it would have beforehand. So the hardship is being shared to some extent. Yeah.
Right. Well, that's fair. But also what you were saying is, you know, yes, the alimony amount will be lower. But the other thing is that the expenses don't go lower. The expenses, even though psychologically you can tell this person you're getting more because it's not being taxed. Okay, but my expenses didn't get cut in half, or, you know, my expenses didn't go down just because my alimony amount is down. So even though you're getting an equivalent amount of alimony, those expenses will not be adjusted. So I think that's kind of where, you know, sometimes that lower amount, alimony amount, is not enough to support.
I think that's where the recipient of the alimony needs to have a little bit of financial coaching along the way to show him or her whether they are actually able to make ends meet, or how they're able to make ends meet with their new income, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've done an analysis, you know, just kind of off the cuff, you know, what it takes a woman to stay in a home here in New England, you know, Boston, North and South, West, with two kids, and it's over $100,000. I mean, that's in a typical house, middle income family. I have found that a woman, whoever, who's going to take the house and the kids, the majority, or even not the majority of the time, but you need at least $100,000 net of taxes. And, you know, alimony may not be getting that anymore, you know, may not be providing that.
And there's the base that two households are more expensive than one, no matter what.
No matter what.
And we definitely live in an expensive area of the country.
The most, one of the most.
And so this took away... You know, this TCJA law change took away an advantage that was helping pay for that difference.
Yes. Okay.
And it is a sort of a harsh reality sometimes of divorce that people are faced with not being able to have the same lifestyle. I mean, talking about alimony, the goal is sort of to meet that need. And you said you had another episode on that, but need is defined as the marital lifestyle at the time of the divorce. I often am talking with clients about if that's not doable, it's really sort of how are you both reducing your lifestyle?
Yeah.
And yeah. I mentioned the Young case. I think that speaks to a situation in which the assumption was the income was always going to increase beyond what the lifestyle was. That was the potential of why there should be a cap essentially on the, rather than just a straight percentage of the payor's income. But when we talk about the Young case, I think it's interesting to remember that if you're looking at a case where the lifestyle is already being reduced, the cap should not be at that amount or close to that. You should be thinking about a cap after they would get back to the marital lifestyle.
Right.
But there should be some space there if you're thinking about it, negotiating a cap, because it's meant to be not a windfall over the marital lifestyle, but if people are already being reduced beyond the marital, below the marital lifestyle, you sort of have to get back there before you should be talking about a cap.
Exactly. Right. Yep. That's a very good point, because otherwise the recipient will never have an opportunity to continue to move forward. They will be stuck at one place, unless they have, and again, the only way to improve their position is to either bring in more income. So if they're not getting it on the alimony child support end, then they've got to create more income somewhere else, or they have to reduce their expenses yet again to make ends meet.
Yeah. One of the consequences of that TCJA is that before TCJA, we did a fair amount of what is called unallocated alimony, which means to essentially bundle alimony and child support together and to essentially give alimony tax treatment to child support. And in this way, it was creating a little bit more financial space for the couple. And so that has basically be done away with, because there's no tax advantages anymore to do that. But it seems to me that there is an advantage to unallocated alimony that people overlook, and that is enabling the parties to not have a modification when child support ends and they are supposed to take up with alimony. Do you see that happening at all?
I think I more commonly am encouraging people to just call it alimony then, mm-hmm. so that it's sort of an address, potentially even address in the agreement if the intention is for the number to stay the same or change it in some way when the children emancipate. And because it's no longer tax deductible, we don't have the issue of recapture if the number changes at the time of.
Right.
So just sort of building that right into the agreement. And talking about it at the time, though, again, one of the advantages of mediation and collaborative law is that we sort of raise the things of how is this going to be a long-term agreement? We don't have to deal with just the right now. What can we build in to deal with known future events like the emancipation of the children? Mm-hmm. I am more comfortable if we just call it straight alimony, because we know what the law is around alimony.
Right.
And one of the difficulties with unallocated support, there are certainly some advantages to it, and there are cases where I've done it. I am very careful when I do it, though, to be very clear in the agreement about what are the modification rules. What, is it being treated like alimony in some circumstances and child support in others? Because we have different rules for each of these things. Child support is modifiable on any difference in the guidelines. That doesn't mean people always go back, but that's the law. Alimony is modifiable on a material and significant change in circumstance. Those are different standards. And so when you have unallocated family support, which is it? I think the danger of it is people use it, but then don't fully define it, and they risk having something happen in court later when they want to modify that they didn't expect.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really encouraging people, whatever you legally call it, let's be very clear about what your intentions are for the future, known events like children emancipating. Mm-hmm. And if we can work that all out now, what we call it is almost less important than being very clear in the agreement about the intention.
Yeah. And doesn't that fly with the judges a lot better too, having it all spelled out like that?
The judges are looking at agreements for a couple of things. You know, they want it to be clear so it's enforceable. And if you're doing anything that controls modification in the future, they want it to be absolutely clear so that if you're varying from a standard, they know how to apply it in the future, like reducing the risk that two people read it differently later on.
Right.
So, you know, they're generally going to be most comfortable with things following the existing case law and statutes, but people do have the ability to vary. You know, when it comes to child support, not a lot, but when it comes to something like alimony, I will see people, for example, vary from the cohabitation section and yes. say, you know, that section of the statute is written a little bit vaguely. We'd actually prefer to either write it more clearly and identify for us. It happens at, you know, a different timeline, because in the statute, it takes effect at 3 months that there's a modifiability. I've had people say, no, it should be a year, mm-hmm. but we agree to termination or suspension as opposed to just modification, termination or suspension. Mm-hmm. And I've had people take it out altogether and say, you know what, we don't feel like, we both agree that's not a fair section of the statute. So, go ahead.
I think to clarify for the audience, the alimony law has a section about cohabitation, which means that if after divorce and when you receive alimony, you were to cohabitate, meaning having a romantic relationship under the same roof with someone else, that alimony could then be modifiable. Right, potentially even eliminated for the time being, right? And that's what you're referring to, right?
Correct. And specifically, I was just using it as an example of something that by agreement, people can change what the default law is.
Right.
That's an area that they can say, you know what, we want to, in our agreement, do something a little bit different, and judges will approve it, but you have to be really clear when you're doing something different. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, if you don't define something, you're sort of always going with the default law when it comes to modification.
Yep. Now that's a really good point. I agree totally that it has to be defined. Having gone through my own divorce, I know that you and your ex can sometimes disagree on the language, and there could be one word that is, you know, doesn't fit what you're saying. It's just that there's just one word that's creating conflict between the two of you, and that can create problems. So like whenever same thing, Justin, when I'm thinking about something like that, I'm like, how can we structure this so that people know what they need to do afterwards? You know, how are they going to calculate if it's a self-modifying, as my alimony was, we had to calculate it every year, but it was clearly written in our agreement how to do that. And my ex and I agreed. Excuse me. I did the calculation. It worked out fine. We never had to go back to court.
Right. Okay. So I think we've dealt with alimony here. I think we've killed the subject for now. And so let's move on to the other major change that has affected alimony, which is the child support guidelines of 2021. And there are a number of factors in there, but one of the important factors is that with child support historically, so prior to the 2021, the first $250,000 of joint income were considered for child support and the excess over that for alimony effectively, right? And so now that limit has been increased from $250,000 to $400,000. And obviously, most people, even in the Boston area, most couples don't make in excess of $400,000. And so effectively for most people, does that eliminate alimony, Justin?
So there is case law that says that the court can, and it's actually specifically in the guidelines as well, that the court can look at alimony on the income before looking at child support. And so if you just look at child support first, and then you look to the alimony statute, then and it's a case where the total household income is under 400, then there is no income left to calculate alimony. But if you look at the alimony statute first, you might say that changes how we look at child support, or there isn't income to look at child support. And it really, I think, comes down to there are certain cases that when you look at the need and ability to pay section of how to approach alimony, alimony might be the more appropriate method of support than child support, even though it's an under $400,000 case. Right. Now, that being said, there are a lot of cases where you run the numbers and they wouldn't be that different. Right. So it's sort of a distinction without a difference when there's no tax deduction for either one, at least in the short term. Yeah. So, you know, if the child support at certain levels, depending on how many kids you have as well, might be in the 20 to 25% range of the income, and the alimony is going to be in the 23 to 28, you know, it may not be that different. So I think it's helpful usually to run the calculations and see how different it is as part of a conversation. You know, mediation collaborative law, the approach is always more information is better. Let's have the information before we argue over the principle. But there's also that we've already talked about the modification point, right? So if it's a case where you know the kids are going to be emancipated in a few years, and it's probably going to be alimony after that, it doesn't really make sense to just say, oh, well, this is just a child support case. Come back in 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk about that now while we're here.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I think, you know, again, also going back to that unallocated support, it typically works when the kids are older and they're very close to emancipation, you know, or, you know, they're close to graduating, whatever. But when you have younger kids, you know, I think that's a difference. So, you know, I agree. And we totally agree with the fact that just providing people with the information so that they can make informed decisions, you know, doing alimony first and then child support and, you know, doing it in different ways so we can really get a good understanding. And the other thing too, is we've had Fern Frohlin on our show now. We had her last year when we did our child support mini series, and she was on this year for our alimony. She did our first episode on alimony. And what Fern has said as one of the people on the task force for the child support guidelines each in the last 8 years, I believe, and on the Alimony Reform Act task force, she says that the drafters never meant for alimony to be the sloppy seconds. Mm-hmm. You know, like that alimony should, just because we've raised the limit to 400 doesn't mean we got rid of alimony. That's what she has said over and over again, is that we never meant for the person who was to receive alimony to get what she called basically the sloppy seconds, the leftovers. That was never their intent. But I think sometimes it's taken that way.
Yeah,
that's a good point. I think if there's a theme to every time I've heard Fern speak, it's deviation. That there's a lot of room for deviation in the guidelines, and it should be looked at on a case-by-case basis, and that should be what the court can do. The reality is, we all know, and I don't do enough litigation anymore to say what is typically happening in the court right now, but we all know that the court is overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. And so they don't have the time to give every individual case that, you know, complete look at what makes full sense. Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the advantages of mediation and collaborative law, I'm sort of a broken record there, but one of the advantages is that you get to look at what makes sense to the two of you and spend the time on that information, look at the different options. Mm-hmm. And try to find, and if you come to an agreement, almost always the judges are going to approve it.
Yeah.
So that you have more power there than if you go to court, and maybe a judge will have the time to look at that, the deviation arguments, and, you know, and what Fern's talking about in terms of, you know, looking at alimony first, and that they didn't mean to get rid of that, or maybe they won't have the time to do that. And that's right. One of the risks of going to court.
Exactly. Yeah.
So one of the things that I find interesting about child support and alimony. So first of all, child support, the latest update in the guidelines increased sometimes significantly the amount of child support that gets paid. But I think on average, it still pays less than what alimony would pay based on, you know, benchmark figures. So, you know, it seems that maybe it's not alimony that's sloppy second, maybe it's child support. What do you think, Diane?
No, what does Justin think?
I was going to say, certainly as you approach, you know, 200 to 400,000 of income, I think you see more and more that the alimony would be a better deal than the child support, because the child support is based on a reducing percentage, that as you get to those higher incomes, the percentage is going down. And alimony, we usually don't look at that way until we get to really high incomes. Mm-hmm. In terms of a reducing percentage. So the biggest difference, though, is you'll see how far apart they are may depend a lot on how many kids there are. Mm-hmm. Because the biggest change and why you saw a lot of increases on this particular guidelines change, because they change it every 4 years, this change upped the rates for multiple children. And so, you know, a case with one child pre the 2021 guidelines and after may not be that different, but a case with three or four kids, that child support's going to be a lot higher, most likely. And so it's going to potentially approach
especially at higher level. Income, though.
Yep.
Especially at higher income, isn't it?
Yes. Well, it's a percentage increase. So it's going to be across the, you know, that's what's going to affect the same at a higher income as a lower income, whereas the reducing percentage is where you lose out on the higher incomes on the child support formula.
Yeah, I think you mentioned earlier about how it was considered acceptable to do alimony first and then child support. And I know the last time that we had a child support guidelines update, which was in 2017, prior to the TCJA, that there was a lot of discussion about that. And in fact, I think there was a lot of attempted practice around that, but somehow it seems to have fizzled out after a while.
Yep.
Right. And the child support guidelines of 2021 actually specifically say that alimony first is something that should be considered. Do you expect there to be more of these kind of discussions in divorce situations?
From an informational perspective, we should be running it every way and providing people with those options, and they can compare it to their budgets and really think about what their needs are, right? Yep. And I think when we do that, we're giving people the chance to look on both sides. Can the recipient afford their household? Can the payor afford their household? And if not, what do we need to do to make it work? You know, from a litigation perspective, or, you know, if we're looking at the shadow of the law, or what John Fisk said, we look at the light of the law. The Calvin C versus Amelia A case, which is referenced now in the guidelines, specifically deals with that ability to do alimony first and then child support. And so the court can do that. Mm-hmm. So when you've opened that door, it doesn't mean the court will in every case. And in some cases, that would make a little bit of a difference. And in some cases, it would make a huge difference, because there's all these factors, like, well, what is the parenting plan? Because child support's very different on a 50-50 parenting plan than a 2/3, 1/3. Mm-hmm. So I think that case and the new guidelines have made it very clear that that is an approach that can be used. That doesn't mean it's being used a lot by the court.
Yeah, and right? I think, Justin, I think one of the reasons might be is because if you don't provide the financial reports, you know, to show the different calculations, you know, that made the judge isn't, the opposing counsel or the judge or whoever isn't going to address it. So I think this is what I would like to see. I work in litigation, as you know, I do support attorneys and clients in litigation. And I keep saying, you know, here, I can support you by giving you the documentation to show you what the different approaches are. And hopefully the opposing counsel is open enough to look at them and to consider them. We know that's not always the case, that they're just going to shoot
a lot of litigators. I would rather not go there, I think.
But some are, you know, some do.
Some do, yeah.
So, and when they see the power of a financial report that shows the difference, you know, between alimony first, then child support, when they can actually show that, and they can show the cash flow report, and they can show what the budget looks like, you know, then maybe they're able to discuss that in litigation and come to something that meets the needs of both parties.
Mm-hmm. And that's a really good point. The judges don't have the ability to do that on their own, right? They don't have the time, and they don't have, you know, financial software on their computers. They have the child support guidelines. So they can run the child support guidelines worksheet. If you didn't give it to them, you're required to give it to them. But if they want to double check it, they can run that. Anything beyond that is your evidentiary responsibility to provide to the judge, or they don't have to. And frankly, they don't have the time to consider all these variations.
Right.
It's not their job either.
Right. That's the job of the parties or their counsel to present that in a litigation scenario.
Yeah.
And I think outside of litigation, again, it's our job to make sure our clients are fully informed on their options. So it's our job to present that as well.
Yep.
The advantage is, and you both know this, the advantage of doing that outside of court is you can hire one expert for both people to do that, as opposed to, you know, if you're really doing your full due diligence in a litigation scenario, providing what you're talking about, Diane, I think is completely true. Like, you should be looking at both those options, and you have to provide it to the judge for the judge to consider it. Yep. And then really what you're saying is both sides should have an expert to do that, or at least to double check it, you know, in a litigation setting. I think that's what would be required, but it's a lot of additional work.
Yeah.
And one of the advantages of the outside of court work is you can hire one expert to do that for both people.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I used to think that the power of the number is that the numbers was neutral. Mm-hmm. The numbers may lean one way or the other, but that's just how facts do sometimes. But in my old age, I guess I'm getting more and more sensitive to the fact that there is that old saying that maybe makes more sense than I would like to, that there are lies or damn lies, and then there are statistics. And the point there is that a financial report can make a case lean one way or the other. It's not necessarily neutral, right? And I think that's sometimes a danger of the numbers, especially if it is not going to be someone that is hired by both parties, right? Where the person has an obligation to be neutral and therefore to disclose all of the relevant facts.
Well, I think that goes to agreeing on the assumptions that are being used. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, you know, that's where that comes into play. Because if you don't have an agreement on one of the parties' income, and so you're using a different number than the opposing side is using, obviously that's going to create problems. So like you know, you kind of have to, when I am on a case, I'm always like, all right, we need to agree on the party's income. That's the most important piece. And once we can agree on that assumption, then, you know, we need to agree on other assumptions. Whether or not you can do that in litigation, I have been lucky on cases where I maybe have known both of the litigating attorneys, and therefore they've been more open to looking at my reports that I can do. But obviously that's not always the case.
Obviously it's not, no.
Yeah.
No. The other thing that I just thought of when you were saying that, Chris, that numbers are numbers, is the way that we feel about numbers is not the same as numbers actually are on paper.
Correct.
And there's, you know, a lot of interesting psychological discussions around some of this stuff, like specifically the issue of anchoring, I think comes up a lot in negotiation. And if you tell someone that this is a fair number, and then you find out you just did the calculation wrong, and then you tell them a different number, they're going to feel different about that second number, even if you can prove, like, why there was just a typo or a mistake, never mind like different arguments. They're going to feel differently about that second number because of anchoring from the first number.
That's right.
If you had just given them that second number to start.
Yep.
And right. That's such an interesting psychological phenomenon that I think we can use to think about the way that we approach this maybe should be more from a, let's get all the information and put options on the table before we jump to a, this is what you could argue, or this is an endpoint. If we want people really to be open to looking at different solutions, mm-hmm. because anchoring is it's not like there's something wrong with us. It's just how our brains work. But knowing that that happens can tell us a different way of approaching the problem solving to try and avoid that happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's also, there's so many emotions tied to money as well. I mean, it all depends on how you grew up dealing with money, you know? So like all of those, you know, we try, like you said, and you know, I say, well, the numbers don't lie. That's what I always tell people. And I'm neutral. The numbers don't lie.
I've seen more than once. I try hard not to do too much litigation. But I've tried hard. I've seen cases where you have an expert that is hired by one side where the numbers are clearly biased.
Yeah.
And I think that's really the point. And it's problematic with the anchoring part, right? Because I used to describe it as it may just be black ink on paper, but people think of it as carved in stone, right? And then, you know, how do you move someone away from a carving in stone? It's really hard.
Yep. So we're actually up on our 12 o'clock hour here, coming up on it. And I think this has been a really, really good conversation, as I knew it would be, because of you, Justin. So thank you so much for, you know, joining us. We'd love to have you back on it for another episode.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And I think this is a great thing that you're doing. Making sure that people have access to more information is always important.
Yep.
More information is good.
Yep. Very much. Anything else you want to add, Justin, in a closing for people out there?
And there's a theme to anything I say, right? It's try mediation or collaborative first if you can.
Oh, I didn't notice that at all. We're in favor. Diane and I are in
favor. We are very much in favor of that, Justin, as you know. Yep, we agree.
So that's cool. So we'll be back next week with another episode of Divorce Friday. Thank you, everyone, and have a good weekend.
Great. Thank you all.